Chapter 9. Born Again. Again. During our last couple of years of high school, both Lynette and I worked part-time at Manuka's one video store, MixFlix. This should serve to date the business just a bit for you. The video store also had two tanning beds in the back, Cool Rays Tanning. I was 15 or 16 at the time, and my boss, Jeff, was about 22. He had a BMW, which was just insane in Manuka. He might as well have been driving around a spaceship. He was a dashing, young, entrepreneurial guy, and his folks had helped set him up with this video store, which was doing very well. Turned out people liked movies back then in 1980s Illinois. Jeff and I took a shine to each other, despite his insistence on calling me Tricky Nicky. I have found in life that the person signing the paychecks will tend to call you whatever the hell he or she pleases. A couple of other friends also worked there part-time, and the video store was, of course, in a strip mall, so we indulged in meals from the teepee hut, two doors down to the right, and sometimes we'd get beers from Manuka Liquors, one door down to the left. If we needed prophylactics or batteries or lube, we could nip next door to the right to Kodo Pharmacy. In other words, we wanted for nothing. As a responsible young chap, I was trusted to be on the receiving end of such dreamy tasks as delivering Jeff's BMW to him in Chicago and making sure that the ladies in the tanning beds had all the beverages they required. In the days when the VCR was king, you can imagine what a big to-do would be made over films like Aliens, Platoon, and yes, Three Men and a Baby. We practically had to open a new wing to accommodate all of the VHS copies and cardboard stand-ups of Tom Cruise for Top Gun. I enjoyed playing Highlander over and over on the in-house system in the hopes that the populace would come to know the pleasures of the quickening. Little did I dream then that I would one day come to reside on those shelves myself. To date, I think my most popular title in Manuka is Miss Congeniality 2, Armed and Fabulous. Cut to our first semester down at the U of I, where Lynette and I were learning that our affiliation was by this juncture ill-fated. The writing on the wall plainly read that we should part ways, but I wasn't, quite ready to give up my security blanket, by which I mean, of course, her vagina. I could hardly get to sleep at night without curling up in that cozy thicket. Reality continued to splash cold water on our situation, and Lynette finally put her foot down and sent me packing. I went into withdrawal, and although my new friends and my life in theater school made it a bit easier to go on, I just couldn't shake what turned out to be a bit of an obsession. We still spoke often, which of course helped matters very little in terms of my attempt to quit her cold turkey. Interestingly, her sister had just won 3 plane tickets to Jamaica. So Lynette, her mom, and her sister were going to go to the beach for a week. By this point, she had commenced with seeing other guys, which only sprinkled sweet gasoline on the flame I continued to fan. She told me about the Jamaica trip, and I very casually asked, "So is anyone going with you?" "No, just the ladies." "Splendid." An idea was taking shape in the steel trap of my lust-riddled noggin. A goddamn great idea. Over the course of a few conversations, I took note of the pertinent details regarding their travel arrangements. I had seen pretty much every episode of the A-Team, so I knew how to hatch a goddamn plan. I knew my MixFlix boss Jeff's sister, Kelly, worked at Midway Airport in Chicago, which was from where Lynette and company were to depart. So after 24 odd tall boys of Miller Genuine Draft had changed hands, wink, Kelly hooked me up with all the details and a standby ticket to Jamaica the day before Lynette was to arrive. I would infiltrate the perimeter, perform some recon, get the lay of the land, and then just hunker down to wait. I had once flown home from North Dakota, but this flight out of the country was major. Added to which, the whole standby thing was baffling. Then, things suddenly turned from baffling to terrifying when I got the call that my flight was oversold and I was to be bumped to the next day, to her flight. There was only one flight a day, and this was a great many years before Expedia.com, not to mention I was a total babe in the woods when it came to airplane travel. But even so, Kelly told me that I really had no choice. It was either fly on the same flight as my target, I mean the object of my affection, or bail on the plan completely. To this day, I can never tell if I'm ballsy or just stupid, but by God, I generally tend to go for it. I went to the airport armed with some items I had borrowed from the costume shop at school. Ironically, in hindsight, I glued on a full thick mustache, which was very much like my adult mustache. I dabbed some gray into my hair, which was slicked with Brill Cream, and donned aviator glasses. Additionally, I wore a fat suit of two towels wrapped and bound around my middle, along with some of my dad's more conservative school teacher clothes. Average middle-aged guy going to Jamaica was the look to which I aspired, with a newspaper and a small duffel bag. Ignorant of the ways of the boarding gate, I was utterly bewildered when told to stand next to the door whilst all of the ticketed passengers walked right past. I held up my newspaper real cool-like and managed not to wet my dad's brown polyesters as Lynette and her party of three sauntered by, laughing. Once the legit flyers were all aboard, then the standby crowd was assigned seats. So far, so good. I made my way onto the plane, and I'll be goddamned if I wasn't seated one seat behind her, one seat to the right. Okay, okay, be cool. You got this, buddy. I could actually see the right side of her face through the gap between the seats. This was pretty goddamn hilarious so far. During the flight, Lynette got up to retrieve something from the compartment above her, and we actually nodded at each other. I thought, man, are you gonna crack up when I tell you about this later? In my head, I was absolutely living out a fantasy as the cool protagonist in my very own John Cusack super romantic comedy, when in truth, I was 100% stalking this poor young dancer. Terrific. We landed in Jamaica, and having done the recon back stateside, I knew just where to go. I got in a cab and sped to the beachfront hotel where they were staying. It was all feeling pretty insane, what with the tropical climate, not to mention the big Rasta dude driving a Jeep as a cab, blaring some kick-ass UB40. I went into the hotel men's room and donned my cut-off jean shorts, which were still a pretty acceptable garment in the 80s. The moment of reckoning was drawing tantalizingly near. As I had correctly surmised, within an hour of their arrival, they were down on the beach, an incredibly long stretch of beautiful white sand, at the far end of which I sat reading, incongruously, a book of Thornton Wilder plays. Lynette was walking toward me in a bikini, thankfully with some distance between herself and her mom, who it bears mentioning had been a fan, at least up until this point. I walked up to her in my super swayzy cut-off jeans and, just like I rehearsed, stated, "Hey Lynette, how's it going?" Her jaw dropped, amazed. She was clearly feeling something powerful, like probably love, and she said, "I don't fucking believe you did this, you asshole," which means motherfucker in born-again speak, and she punched me in the chest. "I came here to get away from you. This is my vacation from all the crap I have to figure out in my life." Holy shit, I am so sorry. I meant for this to be awesome, but I have clearly just upset you. Sorry, you won't see me again. Then, as though seeing them for the first time, she took a good long look at my jean shorts. Then she took in my book of plays by Thornton Wilder. Something shifted behind her eyes and beneath her intestines. Within an hour, we were having rub sex in the shallow water on the beach. I had had a positive feeling that she would appreciate my surprise, and she did, eventually. But then, after a solid scrump and munch session, she said, "Okay, this was really nice, and now you have to leave. I seriously don't want to see you again. This is my week here. And when we get home, there's no more. For real." "All right." "Okay, All in all, things had gone pretty well up until this point. I wasn't trying to win her back. I think, ultimately, we were both just happy to make our final love time a memorable one. I had happily suffered a chest punch in exchange for a rich romantic coupling in the Caribbean surf. I couldn't help but clench an imaginary cigar in my teeth and utter to the B.A. Baracus in my head, "I love it when a plan comes together." Unfortunately, that was the end of the successfully orchestrated part of my plan. I had been so focused on my big say-anything moment that I hadn't given much thought to the post-coital accommodations. I mean, I was old buddies with these ladies, so I was sure they'd at least let me crash on the couch. No dice. Not knowing what to do next, with all of $70 in my pocket, I went into a payphone and called Jeff back home. "Well, Jeffrey, the eagle has landed, and the eagle has been kissed, but now the eagle is homeless and without much bread. I guess I'll fly home tomorrow. Pick me up?" "Ah, Tricky Nicky. Ha ha. You got some major brass ones, my friend. You got it. I'll see you at Midway." "Great. Now what?" I looked through the phone book and found a cheap place in the mountains. I called up, and the lady was very nice on the phone. She even sent their Jeep to pick me up. Looking back, this was probably a pretty crappy hotel, but for a 19-year-old playing hooky from Illinois, it was a crazy paradise. I was completely enamored of the colonial style, situated as it was amongst the jungle foliage. When I arrived, the manager, Maria, with whom I had spoken on the phone, was just as nice in person. There was a big shindig underway with a live reggae band and everyone was drinking daiquiris. I had never even heard of a daiquiri. Turns out, it was like strawberry rum booze, all cold and shit. Fucking right on. "Ladies and gentlemen, Jamaica." I commenced to dancing with the people and feeling like life was not too bad. I was thinking even of calling Lynette because we really enjoyed dancing together and I thought she would love this music, but then again, this Maria was beginning to be ever more super nice. Long story short, I spent the night with her and she packed me off to the airport the next morning in the blue and yellow dashiki she'd been wearing. Ultimately, this caper turned out to be a really fun way to wrap up a great teenage romance. When I tell this story, people often accuse me of behaving like a stalker, and even in those pre-9/11 halcyon days of travel, my subterfuge could definitely have been interpreted as creepy. But I hope that the story's resolution makes it plain that everyone involved came out of the fray with a satisfied smile. The only downside, really, was discovering that I was allergic to something, presumably strawberry daiquiris, judging from the painful red rash all around my crotchal area. The mustache makes the magic. First of all, Teddy Roosevelt. Pow! How's that for a punch in the teeth? Or mustache? As a mere sprout, mustaches always represented simply manhood to me, as well as heroes, cowboys, and my uncles Don and Dan, who were already my idols and had mustaches that were flinty, bristly, completely virile, and tough as nails. When I was just a little pisser, I knew that I would only truly become a man upon the day that I could grow a mustache. I associated the notion of these noble whiskers mostly with my uncles because they owned tractors, wore vice grip pliers on their belts, and were out in the weather harvesting their incomes by way of cultivating crops in the soil. They were brave, admirable souls to me, they still are, much like Burt Reynolds and Tom Selleck were at the time. A mustache carries with it a little bit of derring do. You're the kind of guy who'll come barreling up doing a power slide in your pickup truck and then give a girl a wink. You know your knots. You know what to do with beef tallow. Freddie Mercury was also a major idol of mine, and he had a badass mustache to perfectly complement his whole leather guy Tom of Finland thing. When I eventually learned that he was gay, I didn't think less of him, I just thought that gay people must be pretty kick-ass then if he was one of them. Before I ever knew anything about sexuality, I just thought he was a rough-slash-pretty-looking dude who could sing his face off. And once I began to learn about the varying sexual orientations of we humans, then I thought he was a rough-slash-pretty-looking dude who could sing his face off. I recently had the extreme pleasure of showing my friend Chris Pratt the seminal 1986 film Highlander, which is required viewing for young men anyway, and I was blown away yet again by the amazing Queen songs that make up the film's soundtrack. Freddie Mercury brought manhood to the stage like few before him and damn fewer since. A mustache tells folks that you're willing to take the bull by the horns. You have a certain amount of gravel in your craw, like many of Sean Connery's characters. Name me one actor since Connery to bring to life such a swaggering sense of manliness, with or without whiskers, but especially with. Can't do it? Neither can I. But by sporting a mustache, I can bring a hint of that stag-like flavor to my own savory life. Later on, Sam Elliott took an awfully fine swing at that feeling with his incredibly aesthetic lip hedge in The Big Lebowski. Portraying the stranger in that film, a man with such life experience, including enough notches on his belt to be able to give advice to the dude for Pete's sake, required a brambly thicket of absolute chaparral beneath his nose, and Sam brought that shit. Hard. I also emulated a lot of sports figures in the 80s. We were really into sports in my house. Mike Ditka and Dick Butkus were the two most Rooseveltian members of the Chicago Bears organization, to my way of thinking. It was an amazing time to be loving sports teams around Chicago because the Cubs, of course, were great. They're always great. Shut up, reality! And the Bears had the best season in NFL history in 1985. Suck my balls, Miami 72. No question. Then Jordan's Bulls showed up. Phil Jackson. Mustache. I was at teen age, a very formative time for me to indulge in revering these superhero-looking guys with mustaches, like Walter Payton, Mike Singletary, all the Bears linebackers, Wilbur Marshall and Otis Wilson, plus William the Refrigerator Perry and Willie Gault. The Cubs were also great upper lip role models, with Ron Say, Billy Buckner, Dennis Eckersley, Fergie Jenkins, and Lee Smith all sporting cool-as-shit mustaches. Cy Young Award winner Raleigh Fingers of the Oakland A's must be included on any such list because he was a bewhiskered badass on the mound who brandished a full-on, snidely whiplash handlebar mustache that was mighty intimidating to any poor sap facing him in the batter's box. Also, Goose Gossage, ladies and gentlemen. Earlier mustached film heroes, Errol Flynn, and really anybody playing Zorro, forever associated for me the gentlemanly pursuit of sword fighting with the mustache. Wyatt Earp brought his hirsute stash to the gunfight at the OK Corral and was justifiably pissed that he was mainly remembered for only that one heroic day, when in truth, his whiskers saw him through careers as city policeman, county sheriff, teamster, buffalo hunter, bouncer, saloon keeper, gambler, brothel owner, pimp, miner, and boxing referee. Now that was a mustache. In the same vein, Mark Twain had the kind of lip bracken to land him on the list of men I've always idolized. His sense of humor always sounded to me like if someone real smart came from my neck of the woods, and he said what he meant. I shouldn't be surprised if, in my later years, I try to emulate his technique even more than I already do, writing stories about mischief while riding the nation's rivers astride a steamboat or a raft. In general, depending on your style, your mustache can read as heroic and lend a granite quality to your visage, or if you go in a slightly different direction, your mustache can connote criminality in a character. I think it's funny that when I'm playing a sheriff, I think, I'm gonna need a kick-ass mustache. But if I'm playing a bank robber, or cattle rustler, or Irish thug, I think, oh, I had better grow a kick-ass mustache. The important thing is to start with the mustache. Everything else can be adjusted around it, forcing your truth to trumpet beneath it, be that truth good or bad, strong or weak, sexy or abhorrent. On the heroic side, Astronauts rock a mustache if they know what they're about. The straight dope is, if we're true to our natures, then we grow a robust beard. That is what was intended by the order of things. Society has put a spin on us, making a clean-shaven countenance the social norm, which, from Ma Nature's point of view, is bullshit. But then, so are air conditioning and saran wrap and Captain Crunch and a bunch of other cool shit that allows us to rise above nature at times. A mustache is a socialized way to say, okay, look, I'll let you see most of my face since that's what we're all doing right now, but if you would kindly direct your gaze to this thorn bush above my mouth, you will be reminded that I am a fucking animal and I'm ready to reproduce or rip your throat out if called upon because I come from nature. In this way, the mustache can be considered a relief valve of sorts, for the buildup of animal preening that most people completely repress. That's what makes a man with a good stash so cool, calm, and collected. It's funny to me that people ask me for tips on growing a mustache. I often reply, I honestly don't know. I was born with this mustache. I just cut it periodically so that it doesn't go down my throat when I'm enjoying my soup. My whiskers grow without any provocation from me whatsoever. I have about as much advice on growing a mustache as I do on growing fingernails or hemorrhoids. I'll tell you this much. My life is always more delicious when I have whiskers on my face, but that might just be because those whiskers tend to accumulate bacon crumbs and scotch, rendering them literally delicious all day long. In response to the query, how do you grow that robust mustache for Ron Swanson? I can walk you through the steps. Number 1, I don't shave my lip area. Number 2, after 2 weeks, I have a passable mustache in the form of long, luxurious stubble. Number 3, I continue to eschew the razor. Number 4, after 3 to 4 weeks, my whiskers have developed to the point where I can play a sheriff who is so tough that he eats nails, but still not Swanson. Number 5, I refuse to shave. Number 6, after 5 weeks, the whiskers growing from just beneath my nostrils have extended down, wire-like, to reach my top lip, a distance of 1 full imperial inch. Now, and only now, may I don the pleated dockers and thick long-sleeved knits of Pawnee's director of Parks and Recreation, with confidence and authority. Finally, I just want to add that I am a character actor, which means that, unlike good-looking actors, your Will Smiths and your Daniel Craigs, who always play, with great aplomb, different versions of the same dreamboat, I, lacking their cheekbones, rely on versatility to color each of my roles with a different crayon or brush. My old pal, Mother Nature, has done me quite the solid by bestowing upon me a thick mane of hair and a rampant growth of whiskers, both excellent basic materials from which to sculpt wildly differing character details. I have deeply relished my opportunities to try disparate hairdos, from mohawk to hippie, and the same goes for the facial bush, from Grizzly Adams' beard to mutton chops to Swanson's stash. The peculiar thing is, people familiar with my television work now seem to expect me to wield the mustache at all times, when in reality I will wear it seldom outside of the shooting season. Having enjoyed my life as an aspiring chameleon thus far, I look forward to many more years of it. Parks and Recreation films for 7 months of the year, and when I add on the month of mustache growth to prepare for the season's launch, that's 8 months, or 2/3 of my year, that I'm locked into that look. Therefore, I take great pleasure in spending my off months looking like anything but Ron Swanson. Sometimes I shave my head bald, and sometimes I grow a large shaggy beard, and either direction sees me happy as a clam. For an actor, donning a character is a strange transaction. Ron Swanson, for example, does not belong to me, and so I cannot in good conscience be him when I am not at work with his co-creators, my boss, and the writers of my show. It's like the Iron Man suit. As much as Robert Downey Jr. loves to play that particular iteration of Tony Stark, it would hardly be appropriate, though yes, it would be awesome, for him to wear that suit to the grocery store or the beach. It's no different than the uniform anyone wears at work. Wearing Ron Swanson in my regular civilian life would feel to me commensurate with a Best Buy employee putting on that blue shirt and proselytizing to strangers at the car wash on the virtues of high-def televisions. I will have to be satisfied with the amazing good fortune bestowed upon me that it's what I get to wear whilst working at the greatest job anyone has ever had. By the way, for those of you listening to this book, you're missing some excellent illustrations that are featured in the print version of the book. For example, there is a list of acceptable and unacceptable versions of facial hair. The acceptable versions have names like The Minimum, The Tracker, The Trucker, and Mr. Natural. And some of the unacceptable forms of facial hair are listed as Emasculator, The Douchebag, Bruce, Prison Pussy, The Nut Smudge, The Fop, Minus Balls, and finally, The Joke. To see what these different facial hairs look like, I recommend picking up a copy of the printed version, available from E.P. Dutton, an imprint of Penguin Random House. Chapter 10. Wax On, Wax Off. Without teachers in our lives, we would be a bunch of sorry dullards indeed. Dimwits and dunces. One of the many gratifying advantages of mammalian life is that the older generation tends to teach the youngsters the skills they need to thrive in these harsh elements. I can tell you nice folks as a flat fact that were it not for the teachers in my own experience, not only would I be unable to extricate the toilet paper from the roll, but I would not ever have even found my way to the John. My parents, naturally, have been my first and best teachers, along with their respective families who shared in the chores. Many hands make light work, and a little handful of joy like myself, not to mention my little brother, two sisters, and a bunch of cousins, provided a workload that was equal to an army of aunts, uncles, and grandparents. Dad first taught me to drive a clutch, followed by my uncles Don and Dan and grandpas Mike and Ray. Each threw in his 2 cents, instructing both me and my cousin Ryan, so that by the time we were 9, after years of gentle lessons, I could engage the consarnate transmission without any crunching. Grandpa Mike's teaching was especially efficacious. He was an old man who didn't have time for maneuvering, so he just went straight at us. I believe Ryan and I were 6 or 7 when he asked us if we would like to sample a chaw of the Red Man chewing tobacco forever in a pouch in his hip pocket. Well, you bet your ass we wanted to try it. Not only did the patriarch of our lives favor this masticating medium, but so did most of our favorite Chicago Cubs. The time had arrived for us to join the Legion of Men, moving mountains of hay and oceans of yellow corn about the county. Grandpa gave us each a portion and said, "Now you just chew it like chewing gum." We complied, champing away in a manner worthy of any swaggering jack down at the grain elevator, if I do say so myself, lasting all of 90 seconds before we both promptly vomited in the yard and lay down in the grass to die. Class complete. Grandpa Mike wasn't fucking around. Later, in my ongoing career as a student, I was to win the teacher lottery not once but twice at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Champaign-Urbana. Permit me to wax on now, if you will, as I unfold the ballad of Robin and Sato Sensei. Robin McFarquhar was my movement teacher. In any given year, he shouldered a variety of classes, like stage combat, circus techniques, deep tissue massage, mask work, intro to your spine, tai chi, and guts. I also took an independent study in piss and vinegar with him. Every student in the department, both undergraduate and graduate, fell under his gentle British wing, and Robin did everything in his power to heap learning upon our virgin, sponge-like spirits and bodies. McFarquhar, with his actions, illustrated to me a quality that I have really learned to look for in an instructor, that he or she be one who continues to indulge in a hungry course of learning for him or herself. When he wasn't laying some delicious tutelage upon us, which meant mainly during summer vacation, Robin was traveling the nation and the world, participating in workshops of all sorts, from Feldenkrais to Alexander technique to stage combat to literally walking on coals. That might sound extreme to you, or at least a tad hocus-pocus, but let me assure you it was anything but. For he would dutifully return to his classroom every fall and do his utmost to inspire us to perform that very act in all of our work, walk on fire. Robin's movement syllabus at the U of I Theater School generally taught one to know and understand the instrument of one's body, along with its possibilities and limitations. Imagine any time you've begun a new program of exercise and some long unused muscle group speaks up and says, "Hey, whoa, 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 you've paid us no attention whatsoever for these 27 years, and now you want us to perform repeated sets of lat pulldowns? Take it easy, sailor." We got acquainted with all of the disparate muscular work teams in our own operations, especially those crews handling the spine, that finicky nerve center from whence all bodily motion springs. Once we had socialized with all of the labor divisions, we then put our company to work in tasks requiring both finesse, juggling, mime, court sword, and brawn, backflips, broadsword, wrestling. As you might recall from your own school days, the divergent realms of theater nerds and athletes seldom experienced any crossover, and so Robin was teaching us merely to be athletes before we could begin to participate in his artistic decathlons. As amazingly delivered as these disciplines were, they were mostly dealing with the vessel. If it was whiskey school, these classes focused on the barrel, with its distinct cooperage, the tinctures in which the oak staves had previously bathed, the truing of the hoops, and the application of peat smoke in some exceptional cases. But continuing this well-distilled analogy, the real pedagogical treasures in Robin's classroom concerned the spirits contained within the cask. The man taught us guts, plain and simple. At the top of every session of circus class, the assembled troupe would recite, "Come to the cliff," he said. They said, "We are afraid." "Come to the cliff," he said. They came. He pushed them, and they flew. The sense of it is, come to the edge of the cliff, face the leap, and be afraid. Then acknowledge your fear, step forward once more, and then push yourself off the cliff. I was lucky, as I was already stupid, so I was ready to take any flying vault that people would watch, but for many of the softer students, ones who had enrolled in the program aspiring to become the next Molly Ringwald, the prospect of attempting a backflip was terrifying stuff. Every one of us was gently coaxed toward overcoming his or her own insecurities, and as a result, flying like a motherfucking eagle. These classes took all of the good parts of self-help ideology and the religious mindset and employed them with the sole objective of instilling self-confidence and creativity in the participants. One of the greatest epiphanies a performer can take on board is the understanding that one must simply fly free. Your flight may be beautiful and sexy, hi there, or it may be awkward and labored, hello. It might be hilariously encumbered by disheveled feathers and an ill-kept beak, or it might be workmanlike and steady, but whatever your aeronautical style, your soaring has just that. Style. Whatever it is that makes you different, weird, unique from the others, it is that, if anything, which will see you prosper. When I managed to work that golden notion through my thick head, it was then that I knew I would be okay. Not everyone will like the cut of your jib, looking at you, Les Moonves, more on that later. But many others will. One simply needs to seek those others and then somehow trick them into buying tickets for your production of gangster rap Coriolanus. In 2012, Robin McFarquhar invited me to come back and speak to the current students of the department, 20 years after my own graduation. I leapt at the opportunity, remembering so clearly how we yearned back in my own student days for professionals working in the business to come and tell us how things stood in the big bad world outside. I sat in front of the assembled department and told them, first and foremost, to be sure not to squander their time in this facility in which we sat, the Krannert Center, which contains four gorgeous, better-than-professional-quality theaters, with accompanying scene shop, costume shop, and light and sound departments, staffed by absolute superstars of their respective crafts. I spoke to the students. I have worked all over the country in theater, film, and television, and I have sincerely never come across a bounty of resources like those contained in this one benevolently bebricked city block of artistic rectitude. You talk weird, they replied. Silence, I commanded. I went on to discuss the pros and, sure, a few cons to working there as a lad, mentioning some faculty members and what have you, and then I came to speak of Robin, who was sitting off to the side, probably willing me to pick up the pace as teachers are wont to do. Let me tell you about this guy, I began, but before I could get another word out, I promptly burst into tears. Oh, sorry. I did not see this coming, I managed to utter before openly sobbing for several minutes. No shit. Even speaking this description of that scene has me welling up with gratitude for that man. Hard as it may be for you to believe, I didn't get to where I am today because I'm so cute. I'm sorry, gentle listener, I should have suggested you pull over to the side of the road before I dropped that thermonuclear shock nugget. Where I am today, by the way, is in class. A class of my own devising, based upon the generous teachings of men and women like Robin McFarquhar, to whom I would say, I shall forever don my largest cap, just so that I may doff it to your life's work. As luck would have it, when I had finished crying like a baby in front of that assembly of 20-year-olds, and I had spoken my heartfelt piece about Robin and his auspicious curriculum, another of my teachers walked through the studio door. I said, "Oh, great, and then there's this guy," and promptly renewed my sobbing. That teacher was Shozo Sato, my sensei. This is a cheap comparison, but it'll go a long way toward elucidating for you the basis of my relationship with Sato Sensei. The original version of the film The Karate Kid from 1984 features an absolutely enchanting performance by the great Pat Morita as Mr. Miyagi. If you've enjoyed the newer version with the winning Jaden Smith and Jackie Chan, then you should definitely check out the old-school flavor. Shozo came into my life and immediately bewitched me and my future Defiant Theater cronies with his kabuki theater class. A traditional 400-year-old Japanese theater form, kabuki literally translates to sing, ka, dance, bu, skill or acting, ki. Kabuki. This very presentational style employs some of my favorite aesthetic tricks and techniques, such as the use of silken fabrics to represent elements like water and fire and blood. To great effect, a stabbing victim might erupt ribbons of red silk from his chest, eliciting gasps from the audience. Or simply the employment of hugely broad mugging during mie poses, which are grandly expressive freeze frames on stage describing moments of great emotion. At such moments in the execution of Japanese kabuki productions, expert audience members will shout either the actor's last name as a great compliment to the performer's skill, or even more flattering, the name of the actor's house, as well as the phrase, "You are better than your father," the pinnacle of praise. So next time you see me in a play, it would not hurt my feelings were you to shower me with such a pronouncement. Another stroke of great fortune in my life was landing a role in Shozo's touring production of Kabuki Achilles in 1991. What started out as an enrollment in a reputedly cool class became a tour of Japan, complete with participation in an ancient theater festival in the small mountain village of Domine. In addition, three or four of my closest new buddies were in the show as well, so we were treated to quite a vacation. For most of the cast, it was our first ever international travel, and Shozo and his wife Alice did an absolutely masterful job of parenting their brood of 20 students, who were incredibly fond of sake, as it turned out. That tour was so rich with beautiful experience and detail that it rather merits its own volume, but one chapter sticks out in my memory. Because Japanese farmers lavish an exceptional amount of attention on the cultivation of their fruits, especially melons, that particular fruit is considered the finest delicacy on the Japanese menu, bringing a price astonishingly more dear than the finest steak. In Tokyo, my dear Joe Faust and I were seeking breakfast one morning in the hotel restaurant when an old gentleman noticed us buying cigarettes from a vending machine. He was very friendly, trying to communicate something to us, the meaning of which we could not discern. Gamely, we kept pointing at ourselves and stating, "Illinois Kabuki," whereupon he would grow excited and noddingly exclaim, "Hi, Kabuki, Kabuki!" He was awfully nice, buying us each a pack of smokes and continuing to energetically speak a stream of unintelligible Japanese. He even gave me an enthusiastic handshake at a certain point, which in Japan was apparently executed a little differently than I was used to. "Kabuki! Kabuki!" It grew a bit strange. Although this man was clearly a big fan of our show, which he must have seen at one of our tour stops, he brought us over to his table nearby for breakfast, it would seem, as he persistently pointed at the melon on the menu, the most premium item, so expensive we were told that it was often purchased as a gift, much like a bottle of fine champagne in the States. Eventually, we thanked him as best we could and called our friend Tetro over, explaining that this gentleman wanted to buy him some cantaloupe. Joe and I withdrew to our people, and as we explained the odd scene to the group, Shozo began to laugh very loudly. He reminded us that the word kabuki, besides representing a revered national art form, was also slang for prostitute, since the style had initially been developed by traveling bands of whores visiting the camps of warring shoguns. Well, I guess that explained the ticklish handshake. Everyone had a good laugh until we remembered Tetro. Running to his rescue, we were surprised to see him sitting with the old man, having a good chuckle, finishing up a beautiful serving of melon. "Best damn cantaloupe I ever tasted," he said. "This guy's a hoot." We never did tell him the rest. Because of my ability to carry heavy objects, Sato-sensei made me a bit of a teacher's pet. Pulling weeds in his garden one day, he casually dropped this bomb. "The act of pulling weeds has the very same impetus that causes war. We're killing these bad shoots so the ones we favor can receive all the sunlight, nutrients, and water. That's all war is, killing weeds." That was the first, but certainly not the last time I was floored by my sensei's wisdom. Over the years, he continued to call upon me for my mulish abilities, at one point hiring my classmate Mike Flanagan, another pilotus, and myself to move him and Alice to their new home in beautiful Mendocino, California. We drove the moving truck whilst Shozo and Alice drove their minivan. Filling a truck with scenery, a false world, and driving it to a new place to recreate that world anew was an act I was quite familiar with. But the notion of making that transition in real life was still quite an adventure to my way of thinking. Shozo always had a real sense of the swashbuckler about him, albeit a relatively small, graceful version. A published master of several Zen disciplines, such as kabuki theater and dance, ikebana, which is flower arrangement, sumi-e, black ink painting, Zen meditation, and the tea ceremony, Shozo had spent the year of 1981 touring the American Southwest in a van, painting the landscapes for his sumi-e book. Pretty badass. By the time I was 23, he had taken me to Japan, Hungary, Cyprus, London, and California, and had gotten me paid for most of it. Faust Flanagan and I were never the leads in his shows, as there were more beautiful actors who were better dancers, but we were dependable, so he kept us around the most. We were called upon for comic relief. In between long elegiac sequences of shifting light and undulating colorful dances in museum-quality traditional costumes of Shozo's design, we would run onto the stage, fall down, and then run off. There's room for everyone. My favorite rule from Sensei was, always maintain the attitude of a student. When a person thinks they have finished learning, that's when bitterness and disappointment can set in, as that person will wake up every day wondering when someone's going to throw a parade in their honor for being so smart. As human beings, we, by the very definition of our natures, can never be perfect. This means that as long as we are alive and kicking, we can be improving ourselves. No matter our age, if we always have a project to which we can apply ourselves, then we'll wake up every day with an objective, something productive to get done. This allows us to go to bed at night in the peaceful knowledge that we've done some good, gained some achievement, however small. Having ears for this lesson has been one of the luckiest pieces of listening I've done, because it has led to my woodworking discipline, one of the greatest joys of my life. There were less refined lessons in Shozo's textbook as well. Visiting Cyprus with a professional tour of Kabuki Achilles, we young men were housed at one point in an ancient monastery in the mountain village of Kalapaniotis. After a week or so, Shozo looked in on us and noticed that the bathroom was in a state of dishevelment much as one might expect from six young drunk men sharing one bathroom. We were thoroughly humiliated when our sensei came fuming out of the facilities, severely admonishing us for our slobbery. And not just here, he said, lecturing us. Any bathroom you ever use, if there is a mess, doesn't even matter if you made the mess. The next person to use the room will think you made the mess. What if your mother was coming to use this bathroom? Heavy, heavy, deep shit, and true. I have never been in a messy restroom since without thinking of that day. His mentality then further ties me directly to the Wendell Berry of it all. For if we think of others in our fastidiousness or lack thereof around the toilet, how can we not extrapolate that notion into how we're leaving the rest of the world for the others who will come to use it after us? His most all-encompassing bit of erudition is perhaps found in the Zen koan, "The way of the arts is the way of the Buddha." According to Sato Sensei, Buddhist teachings tell us that we must strive to return to the purity of the day we were born. In the performing arts, the visual arts, as well as the martial arts, when you are completely focused on your art, you're in that pure state. Therefore, the passage, the way of creating art, is the same as the way of the Buddha. I love the focus that this sensibility places on the importance of one's art in regards to a person's inner journey, as opposed to all the attention paid today to the exterior effects of artistic performance. Like Robin McFarquhar, Shozo Sato Sensei continues to be an important influence in my life, so it seems like they're getting the pretty short end of the stick. I took their classes, I graduated, and now they have to continue to teach me? Whatever the case, they seem to persevere without complaint, which is, I suppose, the teacher's lot. When Megan and I were married in our backyard, Shozo performed a tea ceremony for us as part of the proceedings, a rite which felt profoundly more sacred than the recitation of any corresponding Western religious dogma. Our marriage is 10 years strong as of this writing, so I guess that hearty bowl of green tea was a pretty good batch. I have been lucky enough to see and do a great deal in my 43 years of life, but I have not discovered a greater treasure than a good teacher. My only hope is that I can begin to repay them by passing their lessons along to anybody with their ears on right. Make a goddamn gift. This chapter hopes to serve as a gentle reminder to myself and all the rest of us to make our gift-giving opportunities in life count. To my way of thinking, the tradition of giving and receiving gifts has been all but ruined by the general prosperity and largesse that we enjoy in America and much of the world today, in effect devaluing the very value and meaning of gifts themselves. The circumstance that makes us so soft as a society is to be found in our complete achievement of personal comfort. The vast majority of our nation's people can pretty much buy anything they need. Not anything they want, necessarily, but anything they need to achieve a satisfactory degree of creature comfort. Clothing, water, shoes, shelter, food. Beer, throwing stars, charcoal, Doritos, diapers, iPhone apps. You know, the staples. We're all complicit here, holding hands, or linking arms, rather, so we can look at Twitter, whilst huddled together in our handbasket, barreling straight to hell. To wit, if you had the sand to suggest to me that I lower the window of my vehicle by the method of the downright cardiovascular exercise of pumping a window crank lever around in circles, literally moving the window with my mechanical exertions, I'd pitch a fit that you could hear for a country mile. Holy good Christ, we have made things so goddamn easy for ourselves. Finding our schedules relieved of so many of the tedious household tasks that wore our parents' fingerprints off, we find ourselves with a surplus of spare time on our fleshy hands. One might proffer the suggestion that we exploit that bonus time to do something like build a canoe, or at least haul one to the creek and paddle it, reveling in the bird song and white-tailed deer that come right down on the creek banks to eat gummy bears straight from our hands. But then one might easily argue that such an activity would require some energy, some gumption, or, God forfend, some work. Wouldn't it be easier, one might continue, to remain inside upon our pillowy duffs, lollygagging in regal comfort? It's a short fall from making that choice to finding oneself online, shopping, and hey, buying things is fun. We love to buy presents for our children, our friends, and our neighbors. In America, there really is a lot of time to kill with all kinds of noble pastimes like shopping, and when you get right down to it, perhaps there is a recipient even more deserving of treats than those aforementioned beneficiaries. I do believe that, as a group, we have determined that we most prefer buying gifts for ourselves. Objects are just so easy to come by. Michael Pollan puts out a new book? Boom, pre-ordered it on Amazon. We can buy ourselves gifts before the ink is even dry on the pages there in the book machine. Once upon a time for me, something commensurate with a Michael Pollan book or a new Tom Waits record would have been the prize of my year, were I to find it waiting under my Christmas tree or unwrap it upon my birthday. I also used to thrill at receiving necessary items as presents, like simple socks or work gloves. Nowadays, I have too many gloves. Because I have purchased leather gloves online that appeared to be a good deal or just because I liked their look. Their nice cut, well-shaped fingers, add to shopping cart, click to complete order, here they come. Prosperity is a good thing, right? Having too many gloves is a state of affairs preferable to working one's hands raw, yes? Absolutely it is. No question. But for me, too many gloves is symptomatic of a larger deficit that I don't feel good about. Because I find that the greater the ease with which such bounty is purchased, at least in my case, the less the significance the giving of it contains. This is why I try harder at gifts. My first line of offense against this sort of apathy is simply understanding the impact of a little time spent. Even merely writing out a thoughtful slash funny card goes a lot further toward signaling your affection than a cute top purchased from that popular garment shopping website. Not only is it apparent that you took the time to select your words and commit them to cardstock, but by gifting a poem or a joke or a few verses of your own, you force the reader to pause in his or her rhythm and consider what you were trying to accomplish when you scribbled those words. That transaction between the two of you is the gift. In it resides a ceremony rife with tradition that outstrips, in my estimation, a great many retail goods. Short on words, draw a flower, draw a frog, draw some tits, always hilarious. Add a triangular bush below 'em for a bona fide slam dunk. P.S. Cards don't have to be your conventional folded thin cardboard or paper. Unlikely objects add a flavor of whimsy that scores a lot of points. A 2x4, a pair of underwear, a piece of fabric or leather. Go nuts. When people admonish me for making Megan a card, I say to them, you make a goddamn card for your significant other. Go to your printer. There's paper in there. Locate it and pull out a few sheets in case of mistakes. Fold one in half and draw a heart on the front. Open it up and write I love you on the inside. Sign your name. You will get kissed big time. You want the bonus round? Go outside and find a tiny piece of nature, a twig, a leaf, a pebble, a shell, a chrysalis if you're really gifted. Adhere your artifact inside the heart and then get stretched out because you're going for a ride to the realm of coitus. Once you've mastered the card, take it up a notch to handmade gifts. Ho ho! You think you like the card-fueled oral pleasurings you're receiving now? Just wait until he or she gets a load of the scarf you have knit for him or her. That won't be the only load exchanged that night. Making gifts is also a great way to perpetuate a hobby in a productive way, and a solid hobby can keep you out of the hair of your significant other. What do you know? That's another gift. Don't have the time slash budget slash inclination to take up woodworking or chandlery or glass blowing? No sweat. Step up to some tasty paper mache. I have used this childhood art class technique more times than I can count in my theater work, and it is super fun every time. Well, actually, no, probably I've just used it 17 times. I'm pretty countable. You make just enough of a mess to know that you've achieved something, and you could potentially end up with a sculpted masterpiece. Something I love to do as a character actor is to craft my own facial prosthetics for the stage, which is a fancy way of saying that I like to make funny noses. If you cast your face in plaster and then sculpt your new features in clay upon that plaster version of your face, then your noses or chins or devil horns will fit you perfectly, providing countless hours of hijinks. Other fun objects to immortalize in paper and glue are the breasts and the penis. If and when you replicate your virile member, or really any body part, it's key to coat the area with petroleum jelly to prevent an intensely painful hair removal once the paper mache is dry. In the case of a penis casting, one obviously needs to maintain an erection until the glue sets up, which can take several minutes, I've read, so be prepared to sustain an atmosphere of arousal for the necessary duration. Once you have achieved crafting a successful facsimile, you can also elongate the shaft of said manhood by sculpting an extra couple inches in clay, then adding more paper mache to the extra length, I've also read. When you are happy with your product, you might wonder what the hell you're supposed to do with a papier-mâché version of your rig. Well, I'll tell you. Create a waterproof seal on the inside of the paper dick with epoxy or spar varnish. Glue the base of the shaft to a flat rock or a piece of wood to create a strong, heavy foundation. Gently cut in a urethra or pee hole with a sharp knife and paint to taste. Fill partway with water, insert a nice daisy or tea rose, and you have a darling bud vase. No matter how you decide to spend a little more time on your gestures of giving, the point is just quite simply that you do. You don't have to give a person a papier-mâché penis to get a reaction, but you won't be sorry if you do.